think it is critically important that clinicians at all levels openly talk about these issues, because what we've learned over the years is when you speak of the unspeakable, it gives permission to others to speak about it too.
Welcome to Spread the Light with Dr. David Gabi, where we host conversations to dispel lived experience stigma, stereotypes, and bias, and instead spread nuance, hope, and light. Because stigma festers in the dark and it scatters in the light. I'm Dr. David Gabushan. I'm a pediatrician, a public health practitioner, a toddler parent, an immigrant to the U.S. by way of India and the Philippines, and somebody who lives with bipolar disorder. And this month, in honor of the newly named Health Workforce Wellbeing Day, which just happened on March 18th for the first time, commemorating the day the president first signed the Lorna Breen Act into law, I'm thrilled to feature three brilliant national leaders who are transforming health worker well-being. As a place to start, between 300 and 400 physicians are losing our lives to suicide every single year in the U.S. alone, at greater than 2 times the national average. And that's just physicians and just the U.S. This is a much bigger and more urgent problem across the health workforce. So first up, we'll hear from Corey Feist, who is the CEO and co-founder of the Dr. Lorna Breen Heroes Foundation, founded in 2020. On the heels of the death by suicide of Dr. Lorna Breen, a frontline doctor, emergency room physician, and Corey's sister-in-law, to address systemic drivers of health worker ill health. The work of the foundation was recognized in 2023 by the U.S. Surgeon General's Medallion Award. I'm proud to serve as an ambassador of this foundation. Let's get into it. I just want to say how moved and inspired I am by the work that you're leading. And I wanted to have a chance to really get your perspectives and your vision on record so that we could pay homage to the wonderful work that you're leading.
Thank you. Thank you for that. Thrilled to have a conversation. It's been a real journey for us. And I think that in some ways we're just getting started and we've got solid footings and really helped to change the penalties and the stigma. I mean, it's kind of a structural stigma in the form of penalties. I also just make a note. Thank you for being vulnerable and sharing your own mental health challenges, because I think it is critically important that clinicians at all levels openly talk about these issues, because what we've learned over the years is when you speak of the unspeakable, it gives permission to others to speak about it too. And I think that we've certainly seen that to be the case, and we've seen how other clinicians have stood up and said, this happened to me, or this is my experience. And as easy as putting a signature block on the bottom of their email that say in therapy sense or medicated for XYZ sense, you know, just little things like that, I think all chip away at this stigma. So it's great to be with you today.
Yeah, same here. And I love how you put that, speaking of the unspeakable, to make it an easier and more normalized experience for others to speak about. Yeah. And Corey, I'm curious if you could give us a sense of how you came to this work. What brought you here?
Sure. You know, I spent my whole career in healthcare, first as an attorney, and then as the CEO of the University of Virginia Physicians Group. I moved from being on the hospital side as a lawyer to then a policy person and then an operations leader for all of the physicians and the nurse practitioners and other advanced practice professionals at the University of Virginia in Charlottesville, Virginia. So that my professional upbringing and my entire career has been in healthcare, really looking out for the impact of the increasing demands around EMR and other administrative burdens on the time of clinicians. And I saw over the last 20 years, just this incredible work shift and burden shift across the clinicians whom I represented. And so it was very, very focused on trying to claw that back on their behalf and trying to use operational initiatives to do that, which we had some really good early success with. And then in the spring of 2020, we made national news when my sister-in-law, Dr. Lorna Breen, died by suicide. Lorna was a emergency medicine leader in a practicing clinician in New York City, and had a singular mental health episode following a really horrible bout with COVID and then returning to the workplace too early, and was so burdened by stigma, both the stigma of her peers or the perceived stigma of her peers and her colleagues, as well as the structural stigma, which she believed was around penalties for obtaining mental health care, that this incredibly bright, vivacious 49-year-old getting her MBA, taking the world by storm, living her dream, amazing human, decided to take her own life. And it was the response by the workforce to her, to the publicity around her death, the publicity that we never asked for, the publicity that we actually tried to fight, but we were unsuccessful in fighting. And so we found Lorna's story in the front page of a couple New York City newspapers 12 hours after she died. And we were so incredibly just overwhelmed with loss and grief and just a myriad of issues that we never would have thought in a million years that we could even have spoken about these issues. And then kind of in this moment of clarity, my wife Jennifer and I decided that we really needed to tell her story and share the story of this amazing, amazing human. And we never would have imagined the response by the healthcare workforce to that story. We suspected, and with my professional career and Jennifer also as an attorney, we suspected that there were issues that Lorna was speaking about that were real. And they certainly were things that I observed, but not on the mental health side, on the burnout side, occupational burdens of administrative burden, things like that. But we never in a million years would have expected the feedback that we receive. And, you know, to this day, every single day I hear from someone new that I didn't know the day before, who reaches out and says, this either happened to me or this is happening to me and we need a better day. And so we've done quite a bit of work in a 3-year period of time to make an immediate and long-term impact on the professional well-being and mental health of our healthcare workforce. And as I said before, I think we're in some ways just getting started on this work and just really honored and privileged to be in this space now, carrying on Lorna's legacy. But really, this is for all the healthcare workers out there who need help. We can't do anything to help Lorna right now, but we know that she cared so deeply about her colleagues and friends, as much so as her patients, that this is carrying on her legacy in her name and the deep caring that she had for her colleagues. But really, this is about taking care of healthcare professionals so they can take care of patients and just do their job.
I'm so sorry for your loss. And I just want to thank you doing this in Lorna's name and legacy and really helping so many other physicians do better and be better in their daily lives. It's huge what you all are doing.
Well, thank you for saying that. There's a lot of work to be done, but some of this work, I'd like to say we're giving the healthcare workforce, particularly employers, the starter kit. We're working on the starter kit. We're working on the first few steps of a whole staircase of operational changes and policy changes that need to come in play here to hopefully change the conversation for the better for the long term.
Absolutely. So looking back at the last 3 years, what are you proudest of having accomplished at Lorna Breen?
I'm glad we have 4.5 hours left for this talk today. You know, the first thing I'm most proud of is that in that moment of clarity, we decided to act and speak out. And it's funny, I know the word proud is right, but it was a real testament to the human condition, particularly during COVID, when hundreds of people came at us, thousands really, who offered help. And we took that help. One of the humans that reached out was United States Senator Tim Kaine. And he said, what can we do to help? He had read her story. And that conversation led to the first ever federal law looking out for the well-being of the healthcare workforce called the Dr. Lorna Breen Healthcare Provider Protection Act, signed by President Biden on March 18th, 2022. That was quite a moment. That was a moment of pride. As you know, as someone who's been in policy for a long time, it takes a long time to create new law, particularly at a federal level. We did this in 18 months, and we really view that law change as the first few steps of a whole body of law that's really looking out for the professional well-being and mental health and health workers. So I'm really grateful for people lending a hand and saying that this is a better day. Sticking with the policy angle for a second, we identified that there were at least 6 structural barriers or penalties to obtaining mental health care that apply to licensed health workers that apply in almost every state and almost every hospital they work in. And one of the most proud things we were able to do was we were able to develop a national badge recognition program and audit medical licensing across the country and begin to audit nursing licensing, as well as audit hospital credentialing applications. And more importantly than that, we've changed now for medical licensing. We've gone from 17 states that were compliant with our recommendations, which are basically consistency with the Americans with Disabilities Act and their questions on prior mental health. We've gone from 17 states when we started to now we have the majority of states. That is progress. That is an impact that will be enduring for a very long time and will benefit thousands and thousands of physicians. Same on credentialing. We have now moved the vast majority of hospitals in Virginia, my home state. We are moving them in buckets. We just heard earlier today from a very large health system that has over 100 hospitals across this country that is going to use our recommendations. So removing barriers and penalties to mental health access is absolutely one of our biggest feathers in our cap. The other is that we've come together and brought together operationally all these different arms of healthcare. So right after we talk today, I'm going to be talking with the American Nursing Association, and I have them in a campaign that we call All In Wellbeing First for Healthcare, recognizing that wellbeing needs to come first for the healthcare workforce. We brought together over a dozen of the largest national associations who don't always get along, by the way. And right. We brought them together to lock arms around the well-being of the workforce. You know, collectively, they represent over 1 million healthcare workers. And in that, we've been able to launch grants to using private money, grants to those underserved populations that couldn't apply for the grants under the Lorna Breen Act, or scaling now a program called All In Caring for Caregivers, which is the starter kit for hospitals and health systems. We launched that program across Virginia. We have every single hospital in Virginia participating in this program. So our All-In campaign and the coalition we've brought together, it's been incredibly. And then I would be remiss if I didn't point to just the awareness work that we've been able to continue to drum up. Speaking about this topic publicly, multiple appearances on morning shows, 60 Minutes, all of the shows, tons of publications, and just naming it. Because for us, we're not licensed healthcare professionals. I don't have any repercussions to my license if I speak about others and the penalties that we really receive. But, you know, in all of that, it's the stories that we get from healthcare professionals who reach out or stand up, like Dr. Christopher Veal did at the American Society of Family Medicine Physicians in Missouri earlier in the year. He stood up in front of all of his colleagues and he pointed at me on stage and he said, "The Dr. Veal Foundation is the reason I spoke up about my mental health challenges and they've helped to save my life." Wow. And it's those kind of things, or getting an email or a message through social media from someone who attended one of my talks who said, "Unbeknownst to either of us at the time that you spoke to me and our group, your words saved my life." That wow. is what I'm actually most proud of after all of it, that those people are here today because of the work. And we will never be able to itemize all of the people mm-hmm. that we impact, but we know they're out there. And
right.
So that's just a few.
Oh, that's amazing. I mean, in 3 years, as you said, an 18-month span of time leading up to really yeah. momentous federal legislation, and the fact that the majority now of states have shifted towards what is optimal in terms of parity between conditions that are mental health and physical health. I mean, I remember when I applied for a medical license in the state of California, it was much before your regulations had come into play. And it was a very onerous application for somebody with a mental health condition, especially a serious mental health condition. It required several hours of additional labor, cost, what have you. And it was a nightmare. And now I look at the questions on the exact same application and they are so much better, so much more humane, so much more equitable. And it is literally thanks to the Dr. Lorna Breen Heroes Foundation that that change has occurred now on so many different levels and at such scale. It's truly remarkable.
Thank you for saying that. And, you know, just a couple things to note there. It's tragic that we got to this point. And it's incredibly important now that physicians and other licensed healthcare workers know the rules. Every time I go to speak with groups of nursing students or medical students and I ask them about obtaining mental health treatment, the vast majority, if not all of the room, universally says we can't get help if we need it because there will be repercussions. When you talk to physicians out there, an organization called Physician Foundation is about to publish their most recent survey results of physicians, and the vast majority, it's like 80% or something, say they won't get mental health treatment because they're concerned about these repercussions. And so now what we know is the enduring part of this work, once we make the change, is to ensure that the workforce knows what the rules are. Physicians and other licensed healthcare workers deserve to know what the rules are. It shouldn't be a hidden, you know, the repercussions for getting mental health treatment should not be opaque. They should be completely as crystal clear as anything else. Frankly, there should be none, but this is the point. The other thing I was going to say, particularly given your prior roles in the Office of the Surgeon General in California, one of the things that we are really, really proud of right now is that September 18th, we will be at the Kennedy Center receiving Surgeon General's Medallion, which is the highest honor the United States Surgeon General can bestow. And so it all continues to layer to a point where we know we're on the right path. We know that this work is making an impact. We are focused in the right areas. And even about your comment about how hard it was for you to go through those applications, you know, within the last year, the American Hospital Association published their suicide prevention guide, identifying three key drivers of suicide. The issue that we're talking about here is the number one key driver of suicide identified by the American Hospital Association. So It makes intuitive sense that if you're a barrier to mental health care, it would lead to suicide, but they've drawn that line as directly as they possibly can. And so if that's not a call to action to wake up and say, you know, we lose 400 doctors a year to suicide in this country, it's twice the rate of the general population. You look at the rates of suicide and mental health by physicians in the United States compared to other countries, and they're the worst off. I think a lot of this has to do with the drivers around billing, the drivers around compensation, and how the workforce is required to document everything it does while running as fast as possible on a hamster wheel, trying to push a boulder up the hill that keeps pushing them back down. How's that a mix of metaphors between a Sisyphus and a hamster wheel? There is something that we can do that will cost us exactly $0.00, which is change these questions. Then we need to tell people about it. And that in and of itself will save lives of physicians and other licensed healthcare workers. Hard stop.
Absolutely.
And yes. So to know that you're able to draw that clear line between the work that you're working on and the impact, and have it be something that has the potential of not only saving the lives of healthcare professionals, but obviously, you know, it impacts patient care, and, as they would say.
Right, right. Why is it that you think we still have the 24 to 28 hour shift in medical training as well as in the physician workforce?
I think there are a lot of things around the practice of medicine, and this is for physicians and for nurses, which have been hidden and in plain sight for the general public and have just been the way that we've always done it. Your example is a perfect one. I'll analogize that or contrast it maybe with a flight crew on an airline. Everyone knows that if your flight is disrupted because your crew has been working too long, that's a safety issue. I don't think the general public knows how long doctors and nurses have been working at any one time. You know, nothing magical happens when you graduate from residency where they cap your hours at 80 hours a week to becoming an attending physician. Nothing magical happens in terms of your ability to sustain a prolonged amount of time without hurting somebody. I mean, that's the tragedy here, is that just like in the airline industry, they did that for safety reasons for the passengers. If there was a real hard look at this, and there has been a hard look, particularly when it comes to nursing shifts, that after a certain period of time, the increase in medical errors rises. But it hasn't really been published very much. I think back to when I was much younger, there was a Dateline, I think it was Dateline episode on wrong site surgery. And that wrong site surgery was because a resident had been up for hours and hours and hours, and that led to a lawsuit. And it also led to limit on hours of training. So all that's to say, I think part of this is the general public doesn't know. There's not been a clear line. The economics are not in favor of this from a medical economics perspective. I remember the hue and cry across healthcare when we had to cap the residency hours at 80 hours a week, because what that was going to do is it was going to require you to backfill that those clinical hours with a higher paid wage person, which is a nurse practitioner or an attending physician. And people are like, what? You know, so a lot of this is antiquated thinking. The rest of the world has moved on and has evolved in a much more employee or workforce friendly manner. Healthcare is one of the few that are lagging far, far behind. And so these are the kind of things that we're trying to chip away at. That's why I said it's important just at a basic level. Healthcare workers need to know what their rights are. They need to know, if I go get therapy, am I going to have a consequence or not? And the answer should always be no. They also should know, do I have to work all these shifts? I was just on a panel at the Aspen Ideas Festival, and there was a physician who runs a nursing recruiting firm. And she was talking about it's one of the largest digital nursing recruiting, I call it matchmaking, they're putting together employers and employees. And she talked about how important it was for hospitals to provide flexible shifts, because that's what nurses are asking for. Nurses are asking for flexibility, but she was looking in her database and only a handful of hospitals were actually listening. I mean, the employees are speaking on these kind of issues. The employers need to do something to adjust their operations so that the workforce can thrive.
Absolutely. I just want to thank you for doing this and helping so many do better and be better. Next, let's hear from Dr. Mona Massoud, a psychiatrist who in 2020 founded the Free Physician Support Line, which is staffed by volunteer psychiatrists to support physicians and medical students in a one-on-one and anonymous way. Just for people who may never have heard about the work that you're doing, can you start how you came to this work?
Yeah, sure. Absolutely. Thank you so much for doing all that you're doing. It is incredible. And the lived experience that you bringing that to the table of your own journey is really huge. I've seen that even in my own work as being almost essential in the main way that people normalize pursuing their own healthcare. So thank you. This is amazing, Devika. I'm so honored to be talking to you right now.
Oh my goodness. Same here, Mona.
So I am an outpatient psychiatrist in the greater Philadelphia area. And, you know, that has been my primary role for a number of years until March of 2020, where everyone may remember was the beginning of COVID as we know it in America. And at that point, many physicians, and you may remember this very well too, our unique lived experience was, you know, we found ourselves at the front lines of this kind of unprecedented pandemic. We're all trying to collaborate and share information from our various backgrounds and specialties on how to navigate all of this. And in those discussions, in these very large tens of thousands of physicians all over the world on social media getting together to talk about this, I, as a psychiatrist, was trying to do what I do, which is read between the lines of what people were posting. And yes, people were talking about diagnoses and imaging and treatment and all of that. But the thing that was a kind of a deafening silence in all of this was, you know, how are they feeling about this? How are they coping with all this? Where is the human in all of this? You know, I see the physician, but where's the human? And as physicians, we all have our red flags, right? When we're seeing things and people are talking about their symptoms. And this was a big red flag for a psychiatrist that they weren't talking about how they were feeling. If anything, physicians have a habit of intellectualizing. And what that means is like, you know, give us facts, give us data, give us research. We can really hide behind those kind of things, but feelings are hard. So what I did when I was seeing this undercurrent that we weren't talking about it, but what we were saying in some of the posts, and I remember one particular one was from an ICU doctor in New York, and he wrote, "Hey, does anybody know of a good lawyer? I want to write my will." And so we'll say stuff like that, right? But you picked it up as I did, which is, why would he be asking that in this context right now? And it's because he is thinking about his mortality, as all of us were, right? And so I wrote my own post right after that one, because it wouldn't leave me alone. Like I said, I'm just an outpatient psychiatrist. I was like, this could very well get lost amongst the thousands of posts a day. And I just wrote my own post calling all psychiatrists who's with me and starting a hotline for our doctors navigating this pandemic. And the response was quite incredible. In that post, what I realized is we have to give permission to first talk about it. But secondly, 500 psychiatrists signed up within the span of a week. And then the support line started about a week later. So there's that.
Wow. So this was to really help people be human in this new moment, born of you feeling like physicians in particular were not really acknowledging those pieces of their own needs. Was this on Twitter? I'm just curious. Was that the platform?
No, it was actually on Facebook. I think it was a COVID-19 physician group, which has, you know, been now long inactive. But at the time, it was like 70,000 were on that group. Yeah, wow. Physicians from all across the globe.
And how many physicians have come through? What have been some of the patterns?
So, you know, this is an anonymous support line. It is free and we don't report to anyone in that regard in order to preserve the sanctity of the space. But yes, there are certain things that we do log in order to A, make sure that we are meeting the needs of our callers where they are, you know, in terms of the subjects that people call about. And also in terms of numbers, we are tens of thousands of calls in. But this is 4 years running. We started in March of 2020. It's still active today. I can tell you a little bit about the patterns on what we've been hearing about from these anonymous physician and medical student callers. With the start of the pandemic, it was very much about this imminent anxiety about what this could mean. Could they pass this on to their families? Especially, we were getting calls from people who were absolute frontliners at the time, you know, ICU doctors, pulmonologists, infectious disease physicians, things like that. I remember, because how can you forget? You know, I'm in the supply closet in my ICU and I just need a moment to get a grip because I know I have to go back out there. I know that the patients need me, but I need to get a grip. And so sometimes it was just holding space. Like sometimes all you would hear on the other line is like breathing. All sometimes you would hear from the other person was just like, are you there? Like just needing that reassurance that someone gets it. And almost like a permission to even have any of these feelings. And the one thing which, you know, we have debrief sessions between volunteers on a weekly basis without talking about identifying information, but more along the lines of the subjects of the calls. And I remember that we were all surprised to find that most of these calls would start off with an apology. The caller would be like, I'm so sorry for wasting your time when this is a deliberate line, you know, for this exact purpose. But they would be like, you know, I'm so sorry for calling. I know that there's people who could use this more than me. And if you need to go, I understand. Like all these kind of things, which is more telling than even what they would talk about. Physicians, we really, really do struggle with validating our own mental health.
Yeah. Feeling entitled to have a story to talk through.
Yeah. It went from the acuity of this whole time and kind of survival mode. But then what was also interesting and normalizing and validating was that the calls would change the subjects to things that had nothing to do with COVID, you know, because we were physicians and struggling with our mental health prior to COVID, which we know, but wouldn't acknowledge, right? And so they assumed that the conversations would shift to you know, family, like, am I a good mom? Am I a good dad? Am I a good spouse? It would shift to even political issues, because of course we're affected by that as well. I remember when the whole tragedy with George Floyd happened and then Black Lives Matter was front and center, African-American and Black physicians were calling about how it felt to be a Black physician and how they felt that, you know, very acutely, even in this profession. And triggered by all of this and all the inequities that, you know, bleed into healthcare. So what we realized from these conversations were that behind the white coat, the stethoscope, was still people who had the same, you know, thoughts and struggles and stuff as everybody else. And that shared humanity that became, you know, what we would give back to them in these conversations. Like, you know, that is something that you should be thinking about or caring about, or you're not weird for having these thoughts or caring about things outside of medicine.
Wow. I'm curious about the workforce. I know it's a volunteer psychiatry workforce. How many people are there? Mm-hmm. What do they do for to really support each other through this and to enable them to do it financially?
Okay. So great questions. And questions I had when I even put out that impulsive post. I'm like, yeah. What do I know about a support line? So basically it came from an if not me, then who attitude, which I'm sure you can relate with, Deepika, because I'm sure your work had to start in some of that mindset. If I don't talk about this, who's going to talk about it? So what that means essentially is, you know, I went in this going, okay, a support line, that makes sense. But what else makes sense? Anonymity. What else makes sense? One person can't do this all on their own. We have to have volunteers and things like that. So that part actually came pretty easily. People were really into that idea and were thinking about it themselves. But from there, we hire a lawyer, which did a pro bono for us, a healthcare lawyer who walked us through the policies and procedures and making sure that, you know, we were within our licensing, that we weren't acting as a physician, but more as a peer, which is what we were. Mm-hmm. That we were not going to do continuity of care with the people we're talking with. We don't even know them, actually, and we're not asking for their information. We're not going to prescribe medications. We weren't going to do those things. What we were doing was, and why it needed to be psychiatrists, is that we were going to be able to apply our various therapeutic modalities we were trained in. We were going to be able to do that without needing additional training. It was already inherent in the field. So that's why we could start so quickly, instead of like, okay, let's train people that you would for the National Suicide Prevention Line and things like that. So there was a standardization. You know, we could standardize who you're talking to. These had to be actively licensed psychiatrists in the United States. We worked with a company who was going to vet that for us and make sure that that was the case for everyone who was signing up. We got our policies and procedures set up. I got a discount from a big company who gave us the number and then the system that I could operate to set up the support line. And then within the group itself, we would have weekly educational seminars, again, pro bono from people like, you know, American Cross First Aid in mental health. We would have people who were the experts in moral injury in healthcare. We would have people who would talk to us specifically about physicians. Sometimes we would have cardiologists or even pediatricians or people from their specific specialty to come and talk to us about what specifically impacts their specialty, what's unique about that specialty that causes burnout for them. And so we were having educational seminars. We would also, and we still do this, where weekly we all meet together and we decompress, like, what was hard for you this week? Did you feel helpless from a phone call or from a caller? Or did you feel like you actually made a breakthrough and you want to share with the rest of the group on a strategy that worked for you? Sharing of knowledge and strategies. And also just we became friends. I'm managing the line. I'm seeing missed calls come through or something because it's busy. You know, I'll contact a volunteer and be like, hello, friend. You know, are you available to take a missed call right now? Something like that. And so it has changed into something that has now become even more shared experience, not just that we're psychiatrists, but we've come together in this very specific way.
Okay.
We have a census of 800 psychiatrists. Of course, what that this means and how we've made sure that we practice what we preach in terms of our own mental health and our boundaries is that, you know, this is completely voluntary. We have signups on a weekly basis. We also have backup lists, like people who are willing to, if it's busy, they're able to sign on and take calls. So that list is 800, but that's total. On any given week, sometimes a person will take 1 hour out of the week. Sometimes people will take 2 hours out of the week. Sometimes somebody's patient cancels and they're like, can you just add me onto the line? So their phone rings or their app rings if there's a call coming in.
And this now your full-time work, or are you still doing other work?
Oh, no, not at all. This is completely still volunteer, even for me. I don't get anything out of it. So I'm still a full-time outpatient psychiatrist, actually. That's still my primary income. We joke amongst the admin that, you know, we were building a plane while we were flying it, essentially. In that process, we launched 1 week, but it's still in the process of becoming a nonprofit entity. What we did, how we financially support this line, basically is through a grant by the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline. So their owner and operator is called Vibrant Emotional Health, and they are the ones who run the 988 number. They run various support lines. They reached out to us at the very beginning when they started seeing us in various news platforms. And they said, you know, we want to support this. And we came back at them saying that it's incredibly important for the integrity of the line that it be run by physicians, because we have an issue with healthcare being run by people who are not in healthcare. So that was going to be something that would cause mistrust amongst our callers. And so we said, we want to remain in control of the line, but are you willing to fund us? And they said, yeah. So we actually still run the line. It is still run all by psychiatrists, the whole thing. They offered us smaller teams that will do small day-to-day inputs. You know, like the volunteers today, they add them on the list, things like that. And they'll make up our sign-up sheets. They'll do some of the back-end stuff. But yeah, they're the ones who are financially supporting us right now. But that federal grant does end, which is a need for us to move forward with making this a nonprofit.
Okay. So kind of in the last 3.5 years, it sounds like the content has shifted, obviously, in all of the ways that you've described. What is your sense of physician well-being? Is it getting worse? Is it staying the same, or is it improving?
I do think it's getting less stigmatized, I will say. There has been more acceptance of mental health as being a valid pursuit, a valid part of your health. I am also seeing more advocacy among systems, which is what we actually needed. With any of these major movements, we talked about BLM, but even with women's rights or any rights, it's not just the individuals that protest, it's also the systemic reform that needs to happen. And for physicians, we have a lot of systemic barriers to mental health seeking, including on like medical licensing. I believe California is good on this regard, but there are other states that their medical licensing applications definitely violate the Americans with Disabilities Act, and they ask for treatment, they ask for previous medications, all this kind of stuff. What they're really trying to differentiate is this person an imminent danger or threat to patient care, not really whether they've taken care of themselves. And so we've been working with the Dr. Lorna Breen Foundation on the language of licensing applications to destigmatize that on systemic levels. A lot of my work and what I was just doing right before our talk today is I was talking to a medical school and their students on mental health, but also systemic mental health within the education system. We have to change the culture of how we encourage each other about our mental health and all of that. I do think this is definitely progress, because we just needed people to even first acknowledge it exists. And I do think people are doing that.
Yeah, that's huge. And even as you're trying to become a nonprofit entity formally, you are strongly enmeshed in this work. So, so thrilled that somebody like you had this idea and that you've been such a force.
Thank you. I'm really thankful because I have a ton of support, and I definitely don't take credit for all of that. It's not a one-woman show here. My family and my husband especially are incredible supports in making this happen and prioritizing whenever I'm like, oh, I have a talk with another physician. And then he's like, yeah, okay. Like, go do what you got to do. Yeah.
That's incredible. Well, thank you so much for talking with me today, but more importantly, for doing this work.
Finally, our third conversation today is with Ms. Janae Sharp, CEO of the Sharp Index, which she founded in 2018, 3 years after losing her physician husband, John Madsen, to suicide. The Sharp Index has a vision to make healthcare the healthiest place to work.
So just to start, do you mind giving us a glimpse into how you came into this work?
Yes. I feel like it just happened somehow. Like by life experience and by just my decision that I was able to make a difference. So as background, I got married when I was 23. I don't know why we have to start there, but we do. And my husband got his MPH. He went to medical school at Geisinger. We had 3 children. During medical school, he had essentially a mental health breakdown, which he never really recovered from. And he died by suicide, didn't finish his residency. He was going to do pathology. He already had a background in pathology and infectious disease. And I went on, you know, to take care of our 3 kids. I got a job doing stuff for patient reminders and went down the road to health IT and started writing about healthcare IT. But I remained passionate about mental health. And I was going to speak at a conference and someone was like, well, are you going to really make a difference here? And I was a little bit worried. Like, I didn't have the complete answer, but I knew that we needed more conversation about mental health. And I knew that largely medicine didn't take mental health seriously. So I started Sharp Index to broadly to advance the mission that we needed to reduce suicide amongst physicians and healthcare workers. And we needed to improve clinician mental health. And that's evolved. I feel like we've been really lucky. Like, we have so many amazing volunteers, especially we have amazing data science volunteers, experts who are able to look at what technology can do and really look at what would make a difference. We also have physician volunteers. And now we're subscribing to this great idea that healthcare should be the healthiest place to work. If we really believe that health matters and that the whole person matters, I think healthcare can be part of healing, even healing some of our larger societal problems that are reflected in care. So we work on lots of different stuff, and we work on helping people individually and helping with narratives around it, whether that be like talking to press or sharing with events or helping communities. But we also work with helping individuals who have lost someone or physicians and healthcare systems who are struggling. I'm most proud of how quickly people will come together for something that they care about. I'm also very proud of the work we've done for people who are in crisis or who have lost someone, because some of the stuff you do is long-term. Like, we have scholarships, we have aid, but when someone comes to you in crisis and trusts you or says, you know, I lost this physician last week or maybe even several years ago, and I don't quite understand why I'm still feeling so connected to it, that's very important. Being able to be there for people. I'm also proud that the way people talk about physicians is more human. It's less like us versus them. It's more this recognition that we've all been through a lot in the past few years and that we need to take care of everyone, including the people who will take care of us or they'll leave. But mostly I'm proud of the people who have come back and said, you know, we could have ended up like John. Some people were there for me when that happened, but not the same way. There weren't a lot of people there saying, this is how you're going to feel, and this is normal, and this is one way to make it better. So I'm intensely proud of that.
That's huge. Knowing everything you know in this space, what are your top tips for how to be there with somebody as they're recovering from a suicide loss? What should a community member or friend do or not do in that moment?
Oh, that's a great question. Thank you for that. I have a few top tips for people. And one is to know where you start and they end. Like when you're trying to be there for someone, it's really important to recognize that what they're going through is separate from you. And you might have big feelings. You might also be going through that loss. And you can be there for people and decide, these are the things I can do to help, without trying to take on the whole weight of their pain. And I also think it's very important for people to realize that we don't really have a lot of education about grief, about death. It's culturally not something that we're very comfortable with. We don't sit there and grieve together in big groups. We have this culture of silence. So when I tell people tips, one of them is to learn about both how other cultures deal with this, but also decide what you want it to be yourself. Like when you're talking to someone about death, but you don't have any of the words to talk about what that feels like, and you've never really seen it, it's a lot harder. And I think my third tip is that you can carry people some of the way. You don't have to carry people all of the way. And there will be times when you can do what you can do. And there will be times when you need to take the responsibility with your mental health to be healed and to be well. The entire process of our lives, I think, is kind of that give and take, recognizing how we can interact with other people and when is the time that we need to heal and when is the time that we need to help. I mean, there are lots of things specific to suicidal people, like talking about it can help. But I think the things that people really need to know is that grief is something you can learn about. And it's actually something that is more predictable than you would think and is more normal. And also that we're not raised with.
You mentioned learning about how other cultures cope with grief. I'm wondering if there's one or two in particular that you think are really better at it than we are.
I think a study just got released about how people in Japan, when they're older, they live like healthier, happier lives. And they have a greater acceptance of loss. So they particularly, I think, have a great reputation for being good at this and also connecting young people with old people. Connecting people with people who are struggling with mental health as a society, instead of having everything separate, they do better.
Right. I'm thinking of more about that really striking first tip that you had about knowing where you end and where that other person begins. And I'm curious if you could say more about that, because it sounds like that's the kind of advice that you would apply if you've seen it done the other way.
I learned it from having a family member with serious ongoing chronic mental illness, where it wasn't really expected that that would go away. If someone has serious psychosis, they might go through periods of times where things are easier or harder, but you don't just expect that to go away overnight. And I think that profoundly changed the way that I approach everything with mental health. Like, what if instead of saying, oh, you're in crisis now, I'm going to fix you and let you go, you said, this might just be how this person's brain works. And I need to decide what I can and can't do to still meet my obligations. Some people are just in crisis. Some people just need one-time help. But usually we need healing that's more long-term. And we also need to drastically alter our expectations for what other people will be doing. If you come bring someone a meal after a death, I think a lot of times we're doing all we can, but they might still have a hard time 2 months later if they're normal people. So that's what I mean by that. Like, understand that you can still do everything good. We talked to a healthcare system who had a physician death a few months ago, and the well-being team had done a lot to help people, and they still lost someone. And one of the hardest things that I heard was they just said, I just want to make sure this will never happen again. And that's something you hear a lot in suicide loss, especially with healthcare workers. And this is a chief well-being officer, you know? And I didn't tell them at the time, but I wish I could have told them, you can't guarantee that. So what does your work look like when you can't guarantee it? For me, it means you still keep going. For some people, they shut down. That's like a larger philosophical idea about mental health, where I think it's an expected disease that we are fully capable of taking care of each other. One person can't take care of all of one other person's needs or all of everybody's needs. But as a whole, we can take care of that.
What have you found to be the most effective ways of supporting someone in crisis? Like when someone comes to Sharp Index, what do they receive that you found really useful?
A lot of the people who come to us in crisis are physicians. So they want to be connected with another physician. And on several occasions, we've had a physician locally through our network just show up and sit with them and talk to them. Showing up in person matters. Yeah. We've also tried to do online support where people can meet with peers. It's very important to have peers. I've also found that there are two types of crisis. There's the acute crisis, where they've kind of reached their breaking point and everything's spilling over. And then there's the crisis that's more prolonged, that doesn't look the same, largely is the same. So for those people, we found that going over truths without expecting a lot is important. Usually when someone's in crisis, the thing they need most is someone to be there. Sometimes it's someone to go do their dishes, something very practical, but someone who will actively show up and not say, what can I do for you? But will say, look, we're going to go on a walk. We're going to go to lunch. And take over and kind of carry that person for a while.
And in that, it's also the ability to know how much to carry that person, how long, and when do they need that separation that you were talking about. How you might be feeling about how they're feeling versus how they're doing in that moment. It is complicated, right?
Yeah.
Because grief is one of those things, especially where things change from moment to moment, day to day. You said 2 months in, you might be in a place where you really need practical support. And it comes and goes. It comes in waves. It's hard to predict.
I always tell people to make it like a calendar thing 3 months out from when someone has a loss and bring them food, you know, because everybody else has forgotten. And also with crisis, sometimes that happens too. Yeah. The compassion fatigue is real. That's why I think we try to do lots of different things. There are lots of different approaches. So we don't just keep doing the same thing and make everybody exhausted.
Right. As you're looking at the field, there's what are in your mind big bright spots, the places to feel optimistic or feel good about our progress?
Oh, I do like the Lorna Breen stuff. Yeah. I liked what they're doing with credentialing and stuff that other people have done too. Like Carol Bernstein with the American Psychiatric Association has been involved in clinician well-being for before it was even a thing. And that's a bright spot. I think for me, the brightest spots are it's really the individuals who keep sharing their stories. Chase Anderson, who shared his story and you know, was published about it. Like, what is this actually like? I think they're a bright spot. But I think in addition, there are more people who are involved in policy and making it safe from a workforce perspective. And that's fantastic. You know, we can look at credentialing. There aren't very many people who are going to lose when we stop asking physicians questions about that. That's a pretty popular thing. There are some things that we need to do that are not as popular, you know, and that will be like a larger cultural change. And I don't know if we can put this in. Sometimes the bright spot is that people are just leaving. People are saying no, because you have to have people come together striking. You have to have that for people to change. And that's not the most popular thing for people who are working with hospitals, but sometimes as a survivor, I'm like, all these people together, they can take power and they can decide care is going to look different. And for me, that's a bright spot because people have been pushed to do too much work for long enough.
Yeah, absolutely. And when you were speaking of the things that are less easy to get behind, I'm paraphrasing what you had said, what kinds of things were you thinking about there?
That is with people who are striking or people who are leaving medicine, like people who are saying no. That's a little bit harder because who's going to take care of the patients in the meantime? Wendy Dean asked me the other day, is the cost of doing business physicians' lives or patient lives? And sometimes the answer feels like yes, they'll work you to death and they'll replace you with someone else, you know? So the method to get there is, I think, what's less sticky. Like, do we trust the people who have made millions off of healthcare to fix healthcare? People talk about which leaders should take control, you know? Is it going to be Kaiser? Is it going to be Amazon? Who's really going to change this? And I think that's less popular because people want to do well. And there's a very, you know, You got to take care of your own family. You got to take care of your own needs. And where the responsibility lies is not always clear. That's a hard question for me sometimes, because like we're mostly funded through individual donors. You know, we've worked with technology companies and we've worked with some grant funding, but societal change versus profitability is tough. And I think that's in healthcare, where you're wanting to do something good, and in mental health, but also bridging that gap between ideals and getting along in the real world is less sticky, because not everybody agrees how to do that, even with the political system, like huge differences of opinion. And that makes some of these changes hard.
Do you feel like generally we're in a place where things are going to get to where they need to be? Or are we just so, so far in your view?
That's such a good question, because things are getting so much better and also not better. So I don't know if I could even answer that.
That's fair. It's really hard to predict what's going to happen in this space because it has been glacial progress. Like, for instance, why do you think we still have a 28-hour shift?
Because not enough physicians just sue them over it?
Yeah. Or patients. I think it's actually going to come down to patient medical errors leading to misdiagnoses and deaths. Like the Libby Zion case, right? For all intents and purposes, that was pretty foundational, but it was in 1984. And no significant changes has come down the pike on work hours, length of shifts, all that stuff. It really hasn't been pushed back against since.
Or even with residency hour requirements, there's no real teeth behind that. Like, do you track your hours? No, then I don't want to hear it. Unless we're getting your residency, your work hours from your actual work in the electronic health record, we aren't really, we don't care. And then that goes back to that hard question. Is the cost of doing business that we will work these people to death? And frankly, the answer for a lot of people is yes.
And the truth is the people who are penalized, like if you were to actually say, hey, I'm going over 80 hours routinely, your program is then up for not being accredited. They're put on some kind of probation and then you suffer as a trainee, and then you don't get your license. You don't get through a program that's accredited. Right. It's just the incentives are so misaligned.
I just think one thing people need to remember is that every change in society starts with one person. And while you can't do everything, every single person can change this. And also that you do not have to do everything and you can still help. That's really it.
Thoughtful and oomph. Filled message to go out with, so I appreciate it. Thank you so much for your perspectives on all of this. Thank you for everything that you're doing in this space and just for being such a light.
Thank you so much for talking to me, and I'm really just proud to be part of this work.